This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Douglas Tallamy's book, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees, published by the Timber Press in Portland, Oregon. Tallamy's name is spelled T-A-L-L-A-M-Y. He's written quite a few books, all of them pretty essential reading, I think, for anybody who cares about our landscape. And I'll be reading parts of the June chapter, where he talks about cicadas, hair streaks, including some pretty bizarre creatures. And from the prologue, he writes, "Oaks support more forms of life and more fascinating interactions than any other tree genus in North America." Parts of the June chapter. One day in mid-June 1987, while I was driving down I-95, to a research site in Maryland, I was startled by a substantial thwop on the car's windshield. What was that? The smear on the glass suggested it had been a sizable insect, but it was too early in the season to be a praying mantid, katydid, or mature grasshopper. Thwop, thwop, suddenly, whatever was thwopping my car was everywhere, flying across the road, up in the air, down to the ground, hither and yon. Too curious to continue on, I pulled the car over, got out, and immediately saw that I was in the midst of a 17-year cicada emergence. Oh, wow, I hadn't seen one since sixth grade when I lived in New Jersey. Periodical cicadas put on one of nature's most impressive displays of synchrony and slow development. Sometimes mistakenly called 17 or 13-year locusts, true locusts are a type of grasshopper. Cicadas of all types are distant relatives of aphids, treehoppers, and other hemipterans. Rather than chewing their food with mandibles, they suck it up with mouth parts shaped like short straws. Sucking mouth parts work well for lots of insects, including cicadas. But it is hard to applaud their choice of what they suck as immature nymphs, the xylem in tree roots. Though plentiful, xylem is just this side of water in its nutritional value. It contains almost no nitrogen and very little in the way of carbohydrates. It also requires powerful sucking muscles to draw it out of a plant. All this is in stark contrast to plant phloem, which carries more nutrients than xylem and is under positive pressure. If an insect, like an aphid, plugs into a phloem tube, it doesn't have to suck at all. The phloem juices flow out all on their own. And this is one of the reasons it takes periodical cicadas more than a decade to reach maturity. By volume, the vast majority of their food is water, and they have to work hard to get it. There are 7 species of periodical cicadas in the United States, 3 species that emerge every 17 years, and 4 that emerge every 13 years. And they are separated into 23 broods, united by the synchrony of their emergence, geography, and the time they require to mature. Some areas of the country, Maryland, for example, have both 13 and 17-year broods. And it's hard to keep track of which brood will emerge next, but generally our northern states, ranging as far west as Nebraska, have 17-year cicadas, while the Deep South has only 13-year broods. When periodical cicadas emerge, they do so by the millions and all at once. We call them periodical cicadas to distinguish them from the more than 150 species of annual cicadas in North America, which appear as adults every year in midsummer. Their common name and the fact that we see annual cicadas every year makes it seem like they have a one-year life cycle. Not so. Like periodical cicadas, annual cicadas spend years developing underground on roots, but they differ from periodical cicadas in that they do not emerge in synchronous broods. Instead, some individuals in each population emerge every year. Besides the enormity and suddenness of their appearances, periodical cicadas have another feature that is hard to forget: their loud and near continuous buzzing. Cicadas of all types communicate with timbals, a set of ridges on each side of their abdomens. Strong muscles on either side of a timbal buckle and unbuckle these ridges, with each buckle making a click by a mechanism similar to the clicking of a soda can by squeezing and relaxing your fingers. But unlike a squeezed soda can, Timbal muscles buckle and unbuckle the ridges so fast, 300 to 400 times per second, that the clicks blend into a loud buzz. This buzz is amplified by a concave resonance chamber located just below each timbal. The end result is one of the loudest sounds produced by any animal. I've been in Costa Rican forests where the buzz of cicadas was so loud and at such a pitch that I had to walk with my hands over my ears. Only male cicadas buzz, and they do it, not surprisingly, to attract the attention of females. If a female hears a male nearby, and if she is receptive and likes the sound he is making, she will snap her wings. The male hears the snap and then moves closer to the female. After several bouts of buzzing and snapping, the pair is united and they mate. Even though young cicadas develop underground, adult females insert their eggs above ground in rows along thin live twigs of a host tree using a stout ovipositor strong enough to slice open the twig's bark. Once inside the twig, the eggs absorb water and mature. After 6 weeks, they hatch, and the tiny cicadas fall to the ground, where they work their way into the soil until they find a tree root. Once there, they insert their mouthparts and suck xylem until they're fully grown. Under good conditions, a mature tree can host 20,000 to 30,000 cicada nymphs on their roots with no apparent ill effects. After the time period appropriate for their species, all the nymphs crawl to the surface and molt into the adult stage within 1 or 2 days. A truly amazing display of synchronization after spending years underground. How they synchronize is still somewhat of a mystery. Cues to emerge may include the temperature of the soil or something within the xylem itself. Whatever the cue, when they crawl from the ground, the cicada nymphs leave an exit hole behind, and after a mass emergence, it looks like someone drilled thousands of half-inch holes in the soil under every host tree. What also remains behind are the shed skins of all the cicadas. Usually, the nymphs crawl a few feet up a tree trunk to shed, but if there's a shortage of tree trunks, they'll just molt on the ground. The shed skins are made of chitin, a very durable material, and they can last many months as a reminder of this special entomological event. So why stay underground for 13 or 17 years? I already suggested the xylem is such a poor source of nutrition that cicadas need years to complete their development. But there must be some other reason. For one thing, there is good evidence that some species of large annual cicadas can complete their development underground in as few as 4 years. So what factors have selected for the extra time delay? Ecologists agree that this curious and extreme life cycle is best explained by predator satiation, the very same phenomenon that helps explain periodic acorn masts. By remaining underground, out of harm's way, for 13 or 17 years, periodical cicadas reduce predation in two ways. First, mass. Synchronized emergence overwhelms predator populations by sheer numbers. There simply are not enough squirrels, birds, possums, raccoons, foxes, and other predators to eat all the available cicadas in a large emergence. Therefore, many, if not most, cicadas survive to lay their eggs. Second, such long periods of time between emergences prevents any one predator from becoming a specialist on periodical cicadas the way cicada killers, a large wasp, have specialized on annual cicadas. If a wasp, like a cicada killer, decided, in the evolutionary sense, to attack only periodical cicadas, it would have to go 13 or 17 years between generations, a trade-off that even periodic all-you-can-eat buffets does not justify. The last time periodical cicadas emerged at our house was 2004, when my oak tree was only 4 years old. They're scheduled to emerge again in 2021. Whether my oak was large enough in 2004 to attract ovipositing female cicadas remains to be seen, but it is certainly large enough now. As with so many other types of insects, oaks are favorite host trees for periodical cicadas, and I'm expecting quite a buzz in our front yard in 2021. Now Talamy goes on to talk about caterpillars in June. In most places, the number of caterpillars using oaks is at its nadir in June, not because species avoid oaks in June, but because breeding birds have already eaten most of them. The caterpillars that remain are either distasteful, too small for birds to bother with, hidden in tightly curled leaf edges or leaf mines, or they're so cryptic they've escaped foraging birds. An amazing example of the latter is Kent's geometer. From eastern Kansas to the Atlantic and Canada to Georgia, Kent's geometer is such a convincing twig mimic that it regularly escapes bird predation as well as curious humans. The best way to see if Kent's geometer is present on your oaks is to use a beating sheet. And he has a sidebar here showing how you can stretch a small sheet, looks like 2 feet by 2 feet square, on a frame with a handle, and he's tapping the branches over it to get some caterpillars to fall. He describes doing it gently. They are never abundant, but seeing a late instar larva is real eye candy for a naturalist. From their posture on a branch to their background coloration to the lichen-like scales encircling their posterior third, Kent's geometers are the quintessential twig mimics and a marvel to behold. An equally bizarre inhabitant of your oak is the filament bearer. If this caterpillar survives bird predation, its main enemies are tiny parasitoid wasps that constantly try to land on its back and eject one or more eggs. The filament bearer is aptly named because it uses four expandable extensions of its dorsal exoskeleton as hydra-like bats, filaments, if you will, that serve to knock parasitoids away before they get a chance to insert an egg into its body. The filaments are hollow and can be retracted or rapidly inflated by withdrawing or injecting hemolymph, caterpillar blood, into them. Touch a filament bearer gently, and it will be happy to demonstrate this unusual adaptation. And then he talks about two heads are better than one. And this is about jumping spiders. I really love jumping spiders. Although oaks support the development of 897 species of moths in the United States that we know of, for some reason only 33 species of butterflies and skippers use oaks as larval host plant. 15 of these, however, are hair streaks. The caterpillars of oak specialists, like the white M hair streak, the California hair streak, and the banded hair streak, don't look much like caterpillars at all. Like all in this family, they look more like segmented, velvety slugs with no clear front or back. They do have a front, of course, but because their head is tucked down and hidden by their first thoracic segment, their front end looks just like the back end from above. Hair streak caterpillars move very slowly, eat very slowly, and usually blend in with their background quite well. As adults, however, hair streaks are more interesting. They are small, well-behaved butterflies that often sit quietly while nectaring on flower heads or just resting on leaves. Like many other butterflies, hair streaks hold their wings straight up over their bodies, but unlike most other butterflies, they keep them still and do not constantly raise and lower them or flutter in any way. When you look at a resting hair streak, then, you're looking at the underside of their wings, which typically have only one splotch of color, usually orange or red, on the lower portion of the back edge of each hind wing. Curiously, there's also a distinct black spot, and each hind wing has a thin projection that, taken together, look all the world like a pair of antennae. And that apparently is the idea. Combined, these features resemble a butterfly head with eyes and antennae. For over 100 years, the false head of hair streaks was explained as being an adaptation to draw the attention of birds away from the real head of the butterfly. Birds usually try to attack the head of an insect to make a quick kill, So if natural selection made birds think the head was actually at the posterior end of the butterfly, a bird could attack it and then only get a mouthful of wing while the hair streak escaped. This explanation seemed logical enough, but there were parts of it that didn't add up. First, hair streaks are small insects that would not make much of a meal for most birds. How often did birds actually chase hair streaks anyway? Second, the false head on the hind wings is even smaller than the butterfly. Could a bird really see it well enough to be misdirected in its attack? Finally, if a bird or human with an insect net did chase a hair streak, the butterfly always flew directly toward the sun, which temporarily blinded the predator if it persisted in the chase. Flying into the sun undoubtedly works well. Why then bother with a false head? In 2013, Andrei Surikov published a paper that resolved these questions and set the record straight on hair streak behavior. He noticed that when hair streaks are resting on leaves or flower heads, they're not as motionless as they seem. The false antennae on their hind wings are constantly and alternately moving up and down, just as if they were real antennae. These movements are certainly too subtle to have evolved as a defense against bird predation, but they're perfect for catching the attention of jumping spiders. Salticids hunt, just as their common name suggests. They have excellent eyes, 8 of them, in fact, and when they spot an insect, they jump on it. Salticids are fantastic jumpers, launching themselves up to 50 times their body length toward their prey, and usually from so far away, the victim doesn't know the spider is near. And like birds, they always jump toward the victim's head. Salticids often hunt prey several times larger than themselves, so they have to make a quick kill, or the stronger prey item would escape. With a series of simple experiments, Surikov showed that the false head of a hair streak is irresistible to a hungry salticid. The spiders always jumped on the wrong end of the butterflies. More often than not, the false head on the wing would then break off, allowing the butterfly to escape, a little marred but alive. The ability to protect yourself from unseen enemies is important if you are a hair streak, because salticids are some of the most abundant predators in vegetation. Most hair streaks that develop on oaks do so in the typical way. Their caterpillars eat green leaves, but a few, such as the red-banded hair streak, have chosen a different route. Rather than eating living oak leaves, they spend their caterpillar life stage in the leaf litter below oaks, eating dead oak leaves. We can only guess what selective forces favored this odd departure from the norm. For having sent most of their nitrogen to tree roots before they senesce, dead leaves are notoriously poor in nutrition. Perhaps there are fewer predators in leaf litter, although that's hard to imagine, but the red-banded hair streak is not the only lepidopteran that develops on leaf litter. Some 30 species of moths do so as well in the United States alone. So there must be a good reason for this odd larval diet. Red-banded hair streaks are among our most common lysanids, but I wouldn't spend a lot of time looking for their larvae. They're nigh on impossible to spot among thousands of brown oak leaves. Knowing they are there, however, gives us another reason to create safe sites for leaf litter and the abundant life it supports somewhere on our properties. The most unusual of all the hair streaks that depend on oaks is Edwards hair streak. In appearance, it is similar to other hair streaks, grayish underwings with rows of dash spots here and there. In fact, it can be a challenge telling one adult hair streak from another in the field. Their larvae also look like other hair streak caterpillars, but in behavior, they differ markedly. Edwards hair streak spends the winter as an egg glued to oak twigs. Soon after bud break, the egg hatches and the tiny caterpillar begins to eat young leaves and oak catkins. As the caterpillar grows, it develops glands on its abdomen that secrete a sugary substance laced with amino acids, the invaluable building blocks of proteins. In combination, this secretion is highly attractive to ants, and when they find a caterpillar producing this valuable food supplement, they protect it from predators and parasitoids as only ants can. So far, Edwards hair streak is similar to many species of lysanids that have a mutualistic relationship with ants. In exchange for sugar and amino acids, ants protect the caterpillars from predators. But when Edward's hair streak caterpillars reach their third instar, about half grown, they do something other hair streaks do not. They climb off their host's oak as dawn approaches into a protective byre, a den of sorts that their guardian ants have constructed out of leaf litter. There they rest for the day, often in groups, and then climb back up into their host tree come evening, where they feed again on leaves through the night. During each of these moves, the caterpillars are guarded closely by ants, and on it goes, down the tree at dawn and back up at dusk, until each caterpillar reaches its full size. At that point, the hair streaks make one final trip down the tree trunk into their byre, where they form their chrysalis. 10 days later, they eclose as adults, expanding their wings and crawling out of their byre for the last time to begin their new life as a butterfly. I'll stop there. So there's something more to think about. The life going on in and below and around your oak tree. I've been reading Douglas Tallamy, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. He's also the author of Nature's Best Hope. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.